Hi everybody. Today is Thursday, October 31st, and Professor Ted Postel here is with us, and we're going to talk about what's going on in the Middle East. Welcome back, Ted.
Well, very nice to be back. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Let's start, Ted, with the Israeli attack on Iran. And many people are asking about this attack. How did you find it?
Well, first, let me say, if you have any viewers who think they have any video of any kind of the night sky, please send me a URL to it, because I've been trying to find things. I haven't been able to find much. What I have seen is difficult to interpret. I can tell you, I mean, there are videos of what are clearly objects coming in. You can see them, luminous objects coming in the sky. There's some video of a bunch of explosions in the sky that people have interpreted as indications of intercepts. I am not able to say that they are not intercepts, but they, it's hard for me to conclude that they are. The reason for that is typically when you see an intercept, certainly you see a fireball, which is at a minimum from the detonation of the warhead on the interceptor, but you can often see, even for a very short interval of time, some kind of debris around the fireball. And I was unable to see that. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. I just from what I could learn from videos, I just didn't feel that I had any indication of what had really happened in the attack. On the other side, it's very clear that the defense had a very important significance that most people would not ascribe to it. This is virtual attrition. When you have a defense system and it has some real capability, you have to use tactics that reduce the chances of losing significant numbers of aircraft. And in the case of the Iran attack, first of all, the Israelis are extremely averse to losses and casualties, much more so than many other countries. And secondly, the political consequences of losing a pilot over Iran and having a pilot as a captured prisoner of war have tremendous political significance. So the net result was that the Israelis chose to use ballistic missiles, standoff missiles in the attack. Now, the problem with standoff missiles is that they deliver a lot less in the way of damage than an aircraft carrying a full load of bombs could do, assuming it doesn't get shot down by an air defense. So the effect was to greatly reduce the number of munitions that could be used in the attack. So from the point of view of the Iranians, disregarding the question of whether or not there were a lot of intercepts, which could have occurred, but I just don't have evidence for it, there was a tremendous reduction in the amount of damage that the Israelis could have done, given the size of their air force and the distances involved. For example, they had to do a significant refueling, typical what's called ferry range. You take off, you land someplace else at a maximum range for these fighters is maybe 1700 or 1800 kilometers. And if you want to talk about a combat range, which means you go out, execute a military mission and come home, you typically divide that by about three. You know, it's hard to, because you have to use fuel over the target. And so, you know, basically the range of their fighters, which they were using for delivering the munitions, is around 600 kilometers. Well, that's not adequate for, you know, reaching targets, you know, and returning. So what they had to do is they had to have significant air refueling. And that's a big complication. And if you assume that a tanker can, you know, an airborne tanker can refuel two aircraft at a time. You could have booms from each of two different wings. I don't know that the Israelis are capable of that. They may only be able to refuel one at a time. But it takes maybe 10 minutes to top off the fuel on a fighter jet. So that means you can have maybe a dozen aircraft refueled from a tanker, which means you might need 8, 9, 10 tankers if you have 100 aircraft or so, which looks like the attack involved roughly 100 fighter planes, maybe more, maybe less. I mean, the total fighter inventory of the Israeli Air Force is maybe somewhere around 300 fighter aircraft, and they can't use them all for all kinds of, you know, solid military reasons. So I would say that the diminution in the amount of munitions that was delivered was very substantial, and it was due to the existence of a capable air defense, which the Israelis were obviously, and I think wisely, not willing to try to fly into. So that's a big factor, because that's a big factor that will persist. I mean, the Israelis will not be able to deliver gigantic blows in terms of enormous numbers. Now, in terms of damage to targets, it's hard to know. There's some information beginning to come out. But I think it was you had Scott Ritter on a couple of days ago, and he was talking about bomb damage assessment. He's, of course, Scott. I mean, I know something about it, but I would defer to Scott in any of these questions. Everything he said was exactly what I would say, with less experience than him, because he's obviously been involved. You hit something, there's all this stuff either inside a building or not. It could have been moved out. And there's certainly, my guess is that the damage to missile production facilities was probably negligible, even though they hit some of these facilities. And that's a big problem for the Israelis. And of course, they have a lot in storage. The Iranians have a lot in storage as well. So my view of the attack is that it was, probably useful from the psychological point of view for the Israelis. But I think the reaction globally seems to be that it wasn't a big deal. And I think that reaction is probably close to correct. That is to say, they were not able to do the kind of damage that they were suggesting they could do. And, you know, short of resorting to the use of nuclear weapons, I don't think they're going to be capable of it. On top of that, I would take this attack as an indication that they really have no ability to attack the nuclear program of Iran, because everything's underground. And, you know, everything that matters is underground. And, you know, if they can't do this to surface targets, they're not going to be able to do it to these deep underground. So there's been a lot of bluster and a lot of fear among certain people who are concerned about Iran's military position, And I don't think that's justified, and this was demonstrated in this particular attack. The fear should be escalation leading to general war. That's the fear. That's the fear that's justified by everyone who's worried about it. But in terms of obliterating the military capacity of Iran, I think this demonstrated that Israel is not close to that kind of capacity, which is what I would have guessed from the beginning. I've been looking at this for a little while and saying, where are they going to get all the munitions delivery? So surely there was damage. Surely it cost capabilities, but nothing close to a knockout blow, not even, you know, suggesting a knockout blow, and certainly an indication that these air defense systems they have a formidable capability to impose what I call, virtual attrition on Israeli forces. That is to say, make the forces just not capable of operating in the way they would normally operate when they don't have to contend with the possibility of air defenses and losing pilots over hostile territory. So it's my best guess at this point. There'll be more, I'm sure we'll get more information.
In your opinion, why did Israelis not do the same thing that Iranian did during the conflict? The Iranian attacked just with missiles. Is Israel capable of attacking Iran without using fighter jets?
Well, I understand that there were drones also used in the attack. The problem with drones is they're like aircraft, and modern air defenses are extremely capable at shooting down airplanes. They have a terrible time with ballistic missiles. But airplanes and drones and even cruise missiles, they do better with than, they're doing much better with, let's put it that way. And the increases in capabilities in these air defenses due to the guidance and control and electronics has been very substantial. I mean, you get fired upon by a modern surface-to-air missile system, you've got a big problem. Whereas in the old days, a good pilot who's aware you're under attack too, can often evade an interceptor. I mean, I wouldn't want to be that pilot. I have friends who have talked to me about their experiences with early generations of surface-to-air missile attacks. And from what I can determine from them, it's a harrowing experience, even if you evade this thing and you know what you're doing. So, now I think it's much harder to use the tactics they use because the interceptors are more maneuverable. They have much smarter, much more advanced homing algorithms. They come in faster. They're faster now. And it just makes it a lot tougher to evade an interceptor if you're in an airplane. And so you really don't want to be fired upon, in a position where you're fired upon by an air defense system. So so the virtual attrition effect is quite substantial when people are not willing or able to fly over the target. And shooting down drones, forcing your adversary to shoot down drones has an advantage in that you could be causing them to expend interceptors because you can't ignore a drone because it's got munitions on it. And if it's coming at something that's important to you, you have to engage it. So you have a relatively inexpensive drone, which is then being engaged by, a typically quite expensive interceptor. But the problem again with that is that the it's not clear to me that the Israelis have the enormous number of drones that the Iranians have. So a kind of reciprocal attack from Iran could involve multiple waves of thousands of drones. And that's just going to overwhelm. There is no air defense today that can deal with that. And we've seen how the Russians have used drones in Ukraine to essentially exhaust the air defenses of Ukraine, because again, the Ukrainians had to engage the drones. And I think we could see that again, in this case with Iran on Israel. The one good thing so far, from at least from my perspective, is that neither side has yet decided to go into a punishment campaign against the other, that is to say, attacking innocent civilians in significant numbers. That could happen. The Iranians have shown a very high level of restraint in spite of lies being stated by lies about attacking civilians that some of the Israelis have been making in public. They have not done that. Certainly there are Israelis, citizens who have been hurt or killed, or soldiers hurt or killed, but that has not been a target specifically of either of Iran. And the Israelis seem to have restrained themselves in this to targeting, trying to hit military installations. Now, if they go after the oil facilities, they can do a lot of damage, and they can really do tremendous damage to Iran. The problem with that is the Americans really don't want the Israelis to do this, because it will have a big effect on the global oil markets. And the United States can't tolerate this kind of fluctuation, nor can Europe, incidentally. And so that is yet to be determined, whether the Israelis will escalate to economic warfare. But so far, I think the situation for the Israelis in any kind of protracted conflict, which it looks like this is going to settle into that, unless Netanyahu shows some common sense, it's not going to be favorable in the long run for Israel. It's just hard to see how that can be the case. And my own, Scott had some fairly tough things to say about the Israeli population supporting this war. And I found myself shocked by the harshness of his statements, and also shocked by the fact that I completely agreed with it. So, because I think Scott was right on. So this is not a criticism. He was very direct and harsh. And I have a lot of friends in Israel who are actually been involved with the military, all of whom disagree with what this country is now doing. They're in a minority, and they're doing everything they can, which is very little because the system is frozen. And the country, Israel, has descended into a state that is beginning to look like Nazi Germany in World War II. Now, people are going to be very upset at me saying this, but anyone who goes to Germany today, as I do regularly, can see what a civilized society Germany is. And also, if you know any history, what a virulent, cancerous society it was when it was distorted by a government that was a criminal government. And what you now have in Israel is a criminal government. And it's a criminal government that is that has got a significant part of its population that, quite honestly, as Scott said, has a criminal mentality. I mean, he's right. I mean, I know these people. I grew up with them. And, you know, I grew up in an immigrant Jewish community in Brooklyn, New York. So when he said Brooklyn Jews, I knew exactly what he meant, because the Israelis I know, when they refer to somebody as a Brooklyn Jew, the Israelis I know, they mean some rabid individual who comes from the United States to live in Israel and wants war. That's what the shortcut, you know, Brooklyn Jew, when an Israeli says that to you, they generally mean somebody who is just out of control in terms of their, inclination toward violence against the Palestinians. And so I grew up in Brooklyn with a lot of these people, and it's an accurate description, I'm afraid. I'm very upset about this. I have to tell you, I'm very personally very upset by this, what I've been seeing. And it's where Israel is now going. And the people who are ethical and recognize the limitations of many of my friends there have been deeply involved in military things. They're just helpless to do anything about the situation. So I feel for them, but for the government, I can't say enough against it. I mean, it's just, it is a criminal government, and the Americans are criminal too, because when you support this kind of just unconstrained murder of civilians, limited only by the amount of munitions these people can muster, which is really what's the limitation that they face. You have to say it's a criminal enterprise. And when you look at the military itself, it's even more problematic. I mean, because, when Operation Barbarossa occurred in 1941, and the Nazis invaded Russia, the Nazi forces murdered people at a fantastic level, and whether it was justified or not, my own feeling is I think it was not appropriate, but the Russian reaction when they took prisoners, German prisoners, was incredibly brutal. And at one level, your first reaction is, how could you be so brutal to prisoners of war? But you can't ignore the fact that these prisoners of war were involved in mass genocides in Russia. Now, of course, I am certain that many people just didn't use their guns in certain situations. There were, you know, many people who objected to it, and you can't openly do that. So you just don't shoot, or you find a way to not be there if it's at all possible. So I'm sure there were many innocent soldiers who suffered the consequences there too. And it seems that may be the case in Israel too. I mean, if they're having 20 or 25% of their soldiers not reporting for duty, as reported by Scott, I was not aware of that. From my point of view, that's a statement in favor of the moral, against the conclusion of a complete moral decay of Israeli society, that there are people who say, I'm not going to be part of this. And if I'm interpreting that correctly, that makes me feel better about Israeli society, not worse. But I don't know what the reasons behind it are and what's going on. And the Israelis are a tough people. They're a culture that, they've been, put in a position, they put themselves in a position too, I should say, of being constantly under threat. And they're pretty tough. So my guess is a lot of these people are not reporting because they just don't want to be part of a criminal enterprise. That's my guess. I do not know this is true, but there is a terrible moral question about Israeli society that is now not avoidable. If you're thinking about the overall situation, the government is, of course, worse, but the population not rebelling against this, people, snipers shooting children, and the sniper who shoots a child is a war criminal. The officer who has oversight on the sniper is a war criminal because it's their responsibility to prevent this. The officers who command the officers who oversee the snipers, they're criminals. This is a wholly criminal activity. And you can't call it otherwise. And you can't just say it's the government. These are people who come home to their families and, you know, have their children there and their wives and husbands, and they're just murdering innocent civilians. You can't say, well, that's okay. How is that different from a prison guard in a place like Auschwitz who goes home and has a family and doesn't, you know, connect what they're doing with their home life? It's that horrifying to me. That's my reaction to it. And I just don't know what else to say about it other than what I've already said.
Yeah. Ted, here is Naftali Bennett talking about what would be the plan of Israel going ahead.
Prime Minister of Israel, Naftali Bennett, to discuss what's next. And sir, let's begin there. What is next? What are the prospects of some sort of ceasefire in the near future?
Well, Israel seeks quiet and security in the region. We want peace, but in order to achieve peace, we have to neutralize the source of war and the source of terror, and that's the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's sort of the head of the octopus of terror in the entire Middle East. Where we stand right now is that Israel has severely weakened the arms of the octopus, Hezbollah and Hamas. We've also rendered Iran's ability to defend itself. We've diminished their ability to defend themselves. And now it's time to hit the head of the octopus, the nuclear program, and the regime itself.
You actually said that same thing on October 2nd, following the ballistic missile attack on Israel. You said Iran had made a terrible mistake and that Israel had its greatest opportunity in 50 years to change the face of the Middle East. That was October 2nd. Have you lost that opportunity?
I don't think so. I think ultimately we should look at this in a whole perspective. And what matters is what we do next. Do we just let go of Iran and let them replenish themselves and fix their air defenses and then begin rearming the whole octopus in Lebanon and Gaza? Or do we go all in and take out their nuclear program and ultimately help the Iranian people topple this terrible regime that's been ruining their own lives for the past decades.
Ted, when you look at, did you hear what he said?
Well, I heard what he said, but you know, it's pathetic. Well, it's Naftali Bennett is a man of some significant intelligence, and so I can only assume. Well, first, he's lying, of course, but that's not a big deal in war. But this is some kind of attempt to look like you have a plan and you have options that you can exercise. And none of those, first of all, they have not cut any heads off or arms off the supposed octopus, whatever that image is supposed to mean. Hamas is still there and fighting. perhaps even more problematic for the Israelis is Hezbollah. They are not going to destroy Hezbollah, no matter how many leadership positions, people in leadership positions they kill. This is a highly dispersed and self-functioning organization. This is not a centralized army. This is made up of many units of dedicated and, unfortunately for the Israelis, well-trained soldiers who understand small unit tactics, which is what you need in a kind of fight in South Lebanon, who are capable and willing to do what's needed to inflict constant casualties on Israeli soldiers. Again, the Israelis have an extremely low tolerance to casualties, very low, understandably given the nature of their society, but that's a vulnerability if you're fighting a war like this. The adversary is deeply committed and is willing to accept significant casualties. I'm talking in combat now, not civilians, but they are willing to accept significant casualties. They're well enough trained that they know how to fight, how to lay traps, how to, you know, run away after they've done some damage and then come back and do more damage. So, and you don't need a general officer that you need a sergeant, you know, to, you know, and the equivalent of a sergeant. So it's not going to be possible for them to take and hold any significant part of southern Lebanon. And all that's going to happen is there's going to be more loss, unnecessary loss of civilian lives in the fight that Hezbollah is going to put up. And I'm sure, I mean, I've known many Israeli military officers who are quite intelligent and understand, you know, the facts of life. And I'm sure there are many military officers saying this, but that information is being ignored. I say being ignored because one of the things that I've always admired about the military officers, Israeli, as also Americans, I should say, but Israeli military officers I've known at least, is these guys are not afraid to say what they think. So I'm sure that these people are telling their superiors and others that this is a bad idea, that this cannot happen. So something is going on within the military that is not good, because if you don't have a military that gives you what you need in the form of accurate feedback, and if you're not taking the feedback from your military, the pieces of your military that know what they're doing, then you're in big trouble. And I don't know if this is true, but I think that in a decade, if Israel is, well, I think Israel probably will be around in a decade, but in a decade, Israelis will look upon Netanyahu like many Germans look upon Hitler, that he led them into a disaster that did extraordinary damage to their country and its future. And so I don't think he's going to be very popular, you know, in the end. But in the end, he could do so much damage to Israel that it could be close to unrecognizable in a decade relative to what it is now. I mean, its economy. I've been trying to find some information. I haven't had a lot of time to do that, but his economy has to be falling apart. There's no way it can be functioning. I mean, first of all, they field a very large army for a small country. The way you do that is everybody who can possibly carry weapons or operate them is in the military fighting. Well, those people are not working. And then, of course, there's the cost to the economy. Although the Americans are giving them fantastic amounts of money, I think improperly, because we are facilitating, we the Americans are facilitating the enormous damage that Israel is suffering and will continue to suffer. So we're not doing the Israelis that I know that are my friends, we're not helping them. And, you know, and they understand that. I had one friend just write me and say, why is Biden doing this? This is an Israeli. Why is Biden supporting this government? This is an Israeli talking to me. You know, this is crazy. They're destroying our country. You know, so it's a really tragic situation, in my view. But, you know, so is Ukraine. I mean, we've done the same. Mr. Biden is going to go down in history. Boy, this guy, it's hard for me to believe that he could be so out of touch. I knew he had his limitations, but I just couldn't believe that a guy could be so out of touch. And even this, you may not have known it. I don't know if it made the international news. This statement he made just the other day about people who vote for Trump being garbage. I mean, Kamala Harris is in a life and death struggle for the presidency. So is Trump, of course. Why would you say something like that, given that she's the one who's running? Just keep your mouth shut. You know, you're not running. You know, just shut up. You know, and you look at this guy, but that's a minor thing. I mean, you know, I was just revisiting this extraordinary intercept of Victoria Nuland's conversation. I was just reviewing it because I was trying to remember some details. And, you know, it's clear at the end of this interview, she's talking about Biden, that Biden was behind this attack on democracy, the Maidan attack in Ukraine in February 2014. So he was in on it right from the beginning. So he's got a long record, which the historians are going to uncover. And I don't think he's going to look very good. And this business with his son, which I don't think, you know, again, I'm speaking as an American voter, so people can dismiss, you know, just I don't think his son belongs in the category with the children of Trump, because the children of Trump were even worse in taking advantage of their position for their own financial benefits. But having said that, it doesn't excuse what Biden allowed his son to do, and he allowed his son to do it. There's no question in my mind, whether it's criminal or not, you know, under the U.S. law, that's another discussion, but it's absolutely unacceptable that he would be constantly taking phone calls from his son with regard to Ukraine and not saying to his son privately, if you're doing this, I will not, you know, I'm not going to intervene. You have your own private life. I can imagine him saying that to his son, but not telling his son, you just do not phone me when you're in a business situation. You just don't. And don't use my name. Because if you do, I'm going to be forced to cut the bottom out from under you, because I'm a vice president of this country. I love you. You can say that. I will do everything I can for you as long as you stay within the bounds of a family. And that doesn't include me supporting you at the cost of the United States, of our foreign policy and our foreign activities. You cannot use your connection with me for that. You know, love you or not, it's just unacceptable. He didn't do that. And I hold him accountable for that. But the biggest thing of all, of course, is killing all these innocent Ukrainians as well as Russian soldiers over a war that, you know, total war of choice, did not have to happen. And he still hasn't figured it out, as far as I can see. He still thinks he's one of the great presidents of the United States. He makes that claim. he's going to go down. He's going to go down with George W. Bush. His foreign policy, as far as I can see, is as ill-informed and as disastrous for the American situation as George W. Bush's policies were. Just catastrophically damaging. And, you know, my Democratic colleagues will be unhappy with me saying this, but I think it's, in fact, in some ways, it could be worse than Bush. I don't know. But, you know, killing all those people for nothing. And, you know, it's just, I just don't know what to say.
And when it comes to the 2024 presidential election, Ted, we have Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. We know that do you think that if Kamala wins in 2024, she's going to pursue the same type of policy that the Biden administration has been implementing during his term?
Well, I think she has a national security, you know, she had a national security advisor when she was running for president, and she took that national security advisor as her advisor as vice president. And what I understand about him, I don't know his work in detail, is that he's quite a bit more reasonable than, well, it'd be hard to be less reasonable than Jake Sullivan and Anthony Blinken, or more incompetent. So there's some chance they will, you know, she will have be getting better advice. The problem she faces is that there is a lot of momentum in the U.S. Political establishment. There are people in all kinds of positions. And for her to chart a different policy, she and her national security advisor would have to have some serious private discussions about doing that, and then try with considerable effort and needing considerable political skills to clean out this stable. And I think it's going to be hard to do. If she tries to do it, I mean, I'll be applauding her all the way, but she may not even know that she needs to do it. I just, you know, people, I have said this before, and I think it's important. It's an important thing to point out. People in government do not necessarily know more than people outside the government. I encounter this a lot, you know, when in my work, they'll say to me, well, how do you know this is true? And I say, well, I've had enough experience dealing with these people to know that they are not knowledgeable. They have been indoctrinated. You know, I have sat in briefings listening to the intelligence people talk to the chief of naval operations, waiting for my turn to get up and brief him. And you say to yourself when you listen to these people, don't these people read newspapers? Don't they have a sense of history? Don't they understand context in the world? You know, they live in a cave and they come up with all these crazy perspectives. And it's not only knowledge, it's a perspective. And, you know, the Soviets eat their children. They, you know, the only thing that matters is survival to the Soviet. They don't care about their people. Even Saddam Hussein cared enough about maintaining his country. He understood he needed people, even if he, you know, it's hard to believe that that people can get away with this, and they talk to people in leadership positions. And so people in leadership positions are not necessarily better. Some very intelligent ones are, but they are filtered out, because the moment you say something that in any way suggests you don't walk lockstep with your colleagues, you know, these people, all of whom have exactly the same policy arguments, no difference between them. The moment you show any deviation from those positions, you get excommunicated. Now, here's a particular experience I had. I, through a series of accidents, Ash Carter, who was the Secretary of Defense, and I were quite good friends at one time. This may sound, it is remarkable. And Ash and I knew each other from the time that he and I were analysts, you know, quite low level in the sense of authority, working for the Congress. And he had very well-informed understandings of what our adversaries looked like. I mean, he didn't think they were, you know, evil empires. He was concerned about our adversaries, and we certainly both agreed that there were problems that we were facing as a nation, and we had obligations as analysts. But it was nothing like what he would be saying when he was a Secretary of Defense. I knew that he didn't believe a thing he said, not a thing. And I saw him make this transition over years. We our friendship broke up at some point, quite harshly, when I discovered that the Patriot missile defense, so it's quite a while ago. It's like in early to mid 1990s. So that's 35 years ago. I discovered that Patriot was not working, and I thought, well, I didn't know what to think, what to expect, but all of a sudden I found out that behind my back, Carter is talking about my analysis being weak. And I knew it wasn't, because I knew that as a technical analyst, I was quite more capable than Carter. I mean, I'd worked with him and, you know, he's very smart. Carter was very smart, wrote very well. Had a strategic way of finding ways of stating things that could be attractive to decision makers. But, you know, as a serious technical analyst, he was not that strong. And so why has he not said it to me? You know, we're supposed to have been friends, you know. Tell me, Ash, where are the technical weaknesses? And of course, it turned out that he was in the process of positioning himself to be acceptable to this crowd of neocons, knowing fully what he was doing. He was, I don't know, a Machiavellian character would be too kind to him. He was a person who wanted to be in a position of authority, who didn't care that in order to do that, he would be pushing policies he knew were counterproductive. So for me, he was the ultimately immoral person. And I told him that. I mean, we knew each other well enough. And I told him, you know, I have nothing to do with you anymore. You know, you're engaging with criminals. And if you want to do that to get ahead in the criminal enterprise, that's fine with me. But don't, you know, we're not friends. You know, I'm not interested in being associated with you or having my name associated with you. But we were, you know, for a long time in this peculiar small community I was in, you know, there was a lot of discussion about the fact that he and I had been good friends. And, so this is the nature of our system. If they're smart enough, like Carter was very smart, he knew what he was, which made him more immoral in my view than somebody who's just a fool. I mean, maybe you're like this guy, what's his name? Colin Cald. He's a fool. He's an idiot. He just doesn't know what he's doing. You know, he's very full of himself. Rose Gottemuller, she's just a climber. You know, she has no vision or anything, just trying to put herself, Mike McFaul, another idiot. But Carter was different in that he had a real intellect and knew exactly what he was doing. But all of these people act the same way. And part of that is well, it's mainly driven by the complete intolerance of people in positions where they can determine who gets into the club to any deviation from their thinking. And you have this permeates the American political establishment. And in fact, one of the biggest individuals who helped bring this about is Hillary Clinton. You know, she arrogant, very intelligent. In her case, I think she believes the nonsense that she spouts because she's shallow, can be very intelligent and shallow, and is arrogant to a point that there's no way of penetrating into her, you know, mind, you know, in being accepted as, you know, George Stephanopoulos was trying to help her when she was in the White House, and he talks about how they were trying to get a health care plan implemented in the Clinton administration and how he was trying to be an aide to her. And anytime he brought up a different tactic, you know, political tactic or approach, he said he would be mauled by her, assaulted by her. And other people tell these stories. So she was an individual who's totally closed. So she surrounded herself with little yes people. And she pushed these people into positions of authority within the Democratic sphere, you know, the Democratic party. So we're talking about an intellectually corrupt and closed group of people that Kamala Harris would have to, in one way or another, isolate or replace. And that's a big job because being president is very powerful, but you really will have to go out and get people who are, they exist, get people who are independent and well-informed. But I do not think that's going to be easy because they will be opposed. Anybody you bring in who shows an independence of thinking. Can you imagine John Mearsheimer being brought in to an administration? Not a joke. Not because he's not capable. I mean, he'd be a fantastically helpful advisor. You couldn't do it. I mean, the opposite, you know, because you have a social system that's going to fight against you and fight against him. So the president has authority, but if you're the King of England in 1500, you still have to worry about what happens when you say, well, we're going to have a new church or something. You know, you got to keep enough people behind you. You know, you can't just do anything you want without a lot of political skill and force and maneuvering. And the same is true of a president. You have a complicated social system you're dealing with. And the politics of that, the bureaucratic politics of it, is very, very, very difficult to deal with. And I just don't know if she's up to it. Plus, I don't know if she understands she has this problem. I just don't know.
Dad,
sorry. But these people are indoctrinated. They're not informed. They're not educated. You know, all these Rhodes Scholars, you know. I've known so many Rhodes Scholars, I always say, well, you know, what do Rhodes Scholars do? They pick other people like themselves. You know, can you imagine Jake Sullivan deciding who should be a Rhodes Scholar on some committee, you know? I mean, or Anthony Blinken. I mean, these are, you know, I have an academic background. I know how these things happen. How do you have these people who are so fundamentally ignorant? They're able to repeat what they've been told in a classroom. They do very well at it. And they're incapable of thinking in an independent. I was in a meeting once with McGeorge Bundy. And what impressed me most about him was you couldn't in any way suggest anything that would influence, that appeared to influence his thinking in any way. He was totally sure of his knowledge relative to everyone else in the room. That's how you get a McGeorge Bundy. You know, not stupid. I mean, he can write beautiful books and sound like he knows what he's talking about. But in effect, he was a dangerous idiot. Although, if you asked him to do arithmetic or to tell you who is the leader of what country and what's their political system, is you know, the basics, of, he could do it without hesitation. So whatever one means when they use the term intelligent or intelligence, intelligence is an extraordinarily multifaceted thing. And the ability to remember, repeat arguments after they've been told to you can be a great asset if you're, you know, if you're a truly intelligent person, which means you have flexibility of thought, you're able to entertain alternative ways of interpreting what you're hearing and what you know. But there's a kind of rigidity that you can find in many people who would meet this simple-minded test of intelligence that many of these people have. They're rigid beyond belief. They're confident beyond belief. And anybody who is confident beyond belief is incapable of understanding alternative views and alternative interpretations of the world. If you're too confident, so I'd sit in a seminar and someone would say something and say, how do you know this? And sometimes I'd actually ask it. And you get, you know, depending on this circumstance, and, you know, at Stanford, you can't even ask that. You know, the Stanford Center there is like a graveyard, you know. This is the truth, you know. All these guys sitting around telling each other what they can't even figure out that the war in Ukraine was lost. I mean, that's, you know, you look at their seminars over the last 6 months, it's like, you know, are governments flexible, or, you know, what makes governments, you know, it's like, what are you talking about? There's a war going on that's going on while there's a multipolar transition of historic proportions going on in the world. I am the last person who would tell you that I understand it, because I'm really a technical guy who tries to understand the physical world so that I can support real decision. I've been very fortunate to know some wonderful people, you know, who have asked for my advice, mostly former ambassadors. We don't have ambassadors today. We have these flakes, you know, just, they know nothing. They just spout nonsense and lies. And, you know, we've destroyed our diplomatic corps. And, you know, there's not, we have a shell of a government, you know, frankly. And how can anyone change that? I hope Harris will try. But I don't know if she realizes what a problem she's got on her hands.
Ted, when it comes to Donald Trump, we know that recently in his interviews, he was talking about that he wants to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine in 24 hours. And on the other end, his pick for the vice president is talking the same way. When you look at these type of rhetorics on their part, and you see they're talking about that maybe Mike Pompeo, he said that probably Mike Pompeo going to be in his administration if he wins.
Yeah, right. Speaking of good judgment, yeah.
You see Nikki Haley, you see Tom Cotton, and here is Mark Pompeo and what he said on Fox News about what Donald Trump is talking about Ukraine.
I don't know what he's talking about. I do know that we were able to deter Vladimir Putin from doing precisely what he did, invade Europe. He's killed innocent Ukrainian civilians. That didn't happen on our watch. Right, Putin takes a fifth of Ukraine under President Obama, not an inch, while I was Secretary of State, and then goes at it again as soon as we leave. So I'm convinced we could have convinced Vladimir Putin not to have done this. Putting it back in the box is going to require real American seriousness, real American leadership, the preparedness to help the Ukrainians do the things that they need to do.
Well, it's a bad joke listening to this man. I don't know what he deterred Putin from doing, because I don't think Putin had the intentions, still has no intentions of doing anything in Europe, in Western Europe. What he wants is a neutral boundary between him and NATO. And if Trump were to say the United States is going to absolutely support a neutral, non-NATO Ukraine, he might actually be able to get a ceasefire very quickly, assuming, of course, he accepts that Eastern Ukraine is now part of Russia. I mean, if he took the offer that the Istanbul Plus, I guess it's being called, that Putin has proposed in some form or other, you could probably end this conflict very fast. You probably could. That's not going to happen. I mean, listen to Pompeo. And by the way, Pompeo has no idea how deeply in trouble the West is if it gets into a protracted military competition with Russia and China. The United States and the West have a privatized arms industry. That privatized arms industry is fundamentally at a disadvantage relative to the arms industries of China and Russia. You don't want a privatized arms industry. I fought that every time I could when I was in the United States. Everyone was talking about privatization. You know, all these faculty members at MIT who are on the boards of companies like Raytheon and stuff, my good friend, this guy, John Deutsch, who's a CIA director, should have been prosecuted for the way he handled classified information when he was director of CIA. He was going around trying to bring academics. In fact, at one point, he brought me into a big study, arguing that you had to privatize the defense industry, further. For example, military laboratories should be run by private corporations, things like that. And I opposed it and still do. Now, what we now have is our military institutions that are mostly run by private profit-making organizations. So when you want artillery shells, they're going to build something that gives them the minimum cost and maximum profit they can make from building those artillery shells. Well, that's going to be a manufacturing facility that's honed to be as efficient in terms of production as possible, and also to have as little extra capability, because extra capability requires capital investment and further investment to maintain its extra capability. A government that is concerned about the ability to expand their capacity if they need it can make those kinds of investments, because it's not done according to the rules of capital. I'm not saying, I'm not anti-capitalist. I'm for it. It's just the nature of a capitalist system. So when you go to Raytheon and you give them cost plus on building, 100 Patriot interceptors a year, or 200 or 500, that's a small number. They're not geared up to build 5,000 a year or 5,000 a month. They haven't set up a production line at the enormous investment cost that would be needed. So you don't manufacture these things one by one by hand. So, if you bought a PC from one of these companies built according to the way they build things, you'd pay $500,000 for a PC that could cost you only $2,000 or $3,000 in a commercial environment, because there's no incentive structure for them to make these big investments. In addition, the people in these companies work for the company. So you go to Boeing and you say, what is wrong with this airplane you just sold us? and you talk to the technician is looking over his shoulder at his boss. If you had built the aircraft because you had an indigenous government capability, where you maybe used certain expertise in industry, there's nothing against using it, but they worked for you, the U.S. government, this person would say, I work for the government. We got to fix this. This is my duty to the country. And in addition, that person costs less because you're not giving them a salary that is oversized because the company that's hiring them is charging you to make a profit on this this individual. So this privatized privatized industry is a fundamental problem that the United States has now. So if you look at a country like South Korea, which is privatized, if we want to build an Aegis frigate, they're costing somewhere about $1.7 billion a ship. The South Koreans can build them for $600 million. They're private. I mean, that's in a private shipyard. So because now, I don't know what the Chinese can build one an equivalent frigate for, but I'll bet you it's $400 million or $300 million. You know, maybe, you know, even if it's $600 million. Now, take a look at China. You look at the Chinese economy. Well, Americans say, well, we have a bigger GDP. It's not true. The GDP of the United States includes vast amounts of money that are involved in the investment industry, not manufacturing. So if you look at the manufacturing capacity of China, which in my simple-minded, not sophisticated economics point of view, is everything. I mean, manufacturing capability is the true base upon which wealth has to stand. China has three times the production capacity that the United States has. Three times. Do you want to get into a war with a country that can produce three or four frigates for every one of yours that has close to the disposable, if you want to call it disposable income? Because this wealth is very close, its overall wealth is very close to ours. So China is gonna beat us no matter what. So only question is, when will they be overtly past us? Now, I hope, I've been saying this, and people can accuse, you know, sometimes you get accused of being unpatriotic for saying this, but I hope Americans learn something about what happened in this Russo-Ukrainian war from that war. The countries we're now facing have tremendous manufacturing capacity. And we do not. You know, we have a system that is fundamentally against us. You know, Lockheed can tell the Congress, give us more money and we'll build more F-35s, but they'll bankrupt the country in the process. And we won't get nearly the number of first-line aircraft that the Chinese could build at one-third, one-fourth, one-fifth the price. And numbers matter. Quality matters too. But we're now getting to a point in the development of technology where the technical capacities, you know, when you build a radar in the United States today, it functions at near nothing works at a theoretical limit, the limit that I would sit down and calculate. But a real engineer who knows what they're doing can get very close to a theoretical performance given the advances in technology. Once you're at that level of technology, the other guy doesn't, they may be below your technology, but and they've already got a base. They're going to be there too, because you come up against the limit of physical law. And you know, the Chinese are not You know, they're not Neanderthals. You know, these guys are really, really capable scientists and engineers, just as the Russians are. And the technology is in some ways behind ours, but it's not going to stay that way. And, you know, so, yeah, the radar on a, you know, Sukhoi 34 may not be up to the equivalent radar on a U.S. aircraft. But maybe it gives them a 5% range advantage, you know, because radar signals diminish as one over range to the fourth power. So you really got to get a lot of extra capability to get additional range. And so 5% change reduction could mean being killed. But if there are five of me relative to one of you, there's going to be a big offset factor from numbers, and that 5% is going to diminish pretty rapidly in the next few decades. In the next decade, I think. I mean, you look at China today. If it weren't so sad, it would be funny. We're in this technology war with China. So what the first thing we do is we say, American companies can't sell first line chips to China. So first thing that happens, and we give Intel money to help them advance their technology. And first thing that happens is Intel lays off 10,000 people. Why is that? Because they lost their market. You know, who's in charge of making these decisions? You know, who's thinking? And then, you know, so we can do 3-nanometer tech, not we, actually Taiwan can do 3-nanometer tech. We're struggling to be able to produce it in the United States. But, you know, the Chinese are now doing 4-nanometer tech. They're just a little behind there. And I have a couple of friends. I'm now in Silicon Valley rather than Massachusetts. I have a rich wife, so I have a second home here. And you know, I have a neighbor, two neighbors who are who work for you know, companies that are deeply involved in the technology in Taiwan and China. And one of them came back from China last year, and he says to me, "You know, the Chinese, they are building these 4-nanometer chips. They're not, but they seem to be as capable as the 3-nanometer chips we're building, because they're using different architectural ideas." I don't know what that means myself, because I'm not a computer analyst, but he does. So he's telling me that you know, these guys are making, so who knows, when they get to the 3-nanometer technology, maybe it'll be superior to the Western 3-nanometer. Or equal, doesn't matter. I mean, you know, 4-nanometers can be pretty damn good for a lot of things you want to do. You know, so we're getting to a stage where the limits of technology, or technology is getting to the limits of what physical science predicts is possible, and that includes technologies available to the Chinese and the Russians. Now, in the case of the Russians, they're solid state technologies are really not at all advanced relative to ours. They're very, very far behind. But they have a relationship with the Chinese, and it's constantly growing closer. And the Chinese will be happy to provide them with the chips they need, and probably with know-how to begin building up their own manufacturing capacity. I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but we'll see. And the Russians have an extraordinarily high level of scientific and technical understanding of military operations and things, and military sciences. And I'm sure the Chinese are developing that. Well, they are. They've demonstrated they're developing that very rapidly. But the Russians are really good at this, and they've been at it a long time. But they've had some severe limitations in certain technologies that, you know, that they know how to do it, but they don't have the technologies in hand. Well, that's coming from China now. And in return, the Russians are providing the Chinese with experience, which you can't learn out of a textbook. That's why you can't reverse engineer really sophisticated things. You literally have to have hands-on knowledge, what I call shop knowledge, which is not simply, which can include a very sophisticated theoretical understanding mixed in with a very high level of practical understanding. And, you know, we're now seeing this, you know, this partnership evolve, and it's going to grow. So I don't think the future prospects for a United States pushing around these countries are very good. And if we get into a war, I've said this, I may have even said this in your, if we get into a war with China over Taiwan, we will lose it. And I want Americans to understand that, because I don't want to see such a war, because I think it's avoidable. And I don't think the Chinese are going to invade Taiwan because they're too smart. Taiwan is such an important trading partner. Why would you want to turn it into a Ukraine, heavily damaged? And, you know, it's so all the Taiwanese have to do is not look like a pushover and they'll be fine, you know, and because China doesn't want to destroy the goose that lays the golden egg. And the Chinese made a big mistake by not, you know, by hunkering down on Hong Kong. They scared the hell out of the Taiwanese. And I understand that. I think that was a mistake. But they're not going to kick down the door and try to kick down the door over Taiwan. It's the Americans who are trying to stoke this into that kind of confrontation. And the Taiwanese, the Chinese don't like this. And, you know, the United States is really running a risk of getting into a war that we have no hope of winning. We have no hope of winning the Ukrainian war. It's finally beginning to seep into the dim world understanding of Blinken and Sullivan. I mean, it's hard for me to believe how you can be so isolated from simple facts that are easily understandable if you did the reading that supposedly made you a Rhodes Scholar. I mean, you there's no, like I said, the intelligence is a complicated thing, but there's no intelligence there of a deeper kind. That's what we're facing.
Thank you so much, Ted, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Well, I hope I said something of use and interest to your audience. Like to say at this moment, though, that because I feel a little guilty not being an expert in many of the things that you had on, but you know, people like Scott Ritter and Doug McGregor and Larry Wilkerson and Dan Davis, these guys have real experience beyond mine, at least in the military areas they're talking about. And I defer to them. I just want everyone to understand. But I do have some understanding of the intellectual framework from which decision-making is done. So this maybe it's my contribution, maybe not.
You're great. You're great, Ted. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you. And I'm sorry for the difficulties with the technology. I'm still working on that.
Yeah,
I have to work with X infinitesimal right now, Xfinity. Okay. Thank you very much. Pleasure talking with you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.